Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing extreme frugality in a culture of excess with Liz Timms.
Yeah, Joel, Liz Timms, she's better known as Miss Frugalwoods, and she's the creator of the award-winning personal finance blog, frugalwoods.com. And she's also the author of the book, Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living. At age 32, she reached financial independence and left a successful career in Boston to create a more meaningful, purpose-driven life on a 66-acre homestead in the woods of Vermont with her husband and their two young daughters.
That sounds like a lot of lawn to mow.
Liz has been featured on The Today Show, PBS, NPR, and The New York Times, and more. So Liz, we can't wait to share your story and give our listeners a peek into what your life looks like there on the homestead. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So Liz, every week on the show, Matt and I, we drink a craft beer. Today on the show, we're drinking a beer called Boss Tweed by Old Nation Brewing. And the reason that we drink a beer, it's to basically say that we're prioritizing the here and now, and craft beer is something we value a whole lot. But what is something that you're super intentional about? What's your splurge or craft beer equivalent that says, you know what, I'm going to prioritize this right now, even while I'm saving for the future?
Is it wrong if I say craft beer?
No, you just become the third best friend in this trio then now.
Listen, so recently my husband and I went to Hill Farmstead in Vermont.
Jealous. Which,
nice.
Thank you. I appreciate that you know what I'm talking about. So no, my husband and I have a great love of craft beer and of good food. You know, I think good food is another thing for us. We go out to dinner once a month. You guys are parents. You understand this. We have a babysitter. Once a month we go out to dinner. I do not think about the total at all. And we don't worry about how much we spend. And for us, that's really an investment in our marriage. It's an investment in the long term. And the same goes for the little vacation getaways that we're able to take without our kids. You know, there is not like penny pinching going on those trips. And so I think when you are planning for the long term, it's also important to think about what you need to do to fill yourself up and to reinforce the things that are important to you. And for me, my marriage is really important. And I don't want to lose sight of, you know, this great person I married just because we have two toddlers, which is not always conducive to, you know, a harmonious life. So I think good food, good beer, I'm with you.
So Hill Farmstead, that's one of your favorites. Liz, do you have any other favorites there in Vermont? Because there is some incredible beer from that great state.
Absolutely. So Upper Pass is another that I think does just a tremendous job. And also River Roost. Have you guys heard of River Roost?
I haven't.
Seriously, haven't heard of either one of those, surprisingly.
So if you have a chance for Upper Pass, their Cloud Drop IPA is...
I want to drink it already.
Honestly, I think it's better than The Alchemist. I'm going to say that. I'm going to put that out there. And then River Roost does an IPA called Mas Verde that... In my mind, move over Hill Farmstead. We have just some incredible small craft breweries here. And I would say that we invest in them heavily. Is that the right word? You know, we drink really good beer. Like, I'm not going to drink cheap beer.
You know, I came to that realization a couple of years ago. For me, it was kind of half and half. And then I decided, you know what? That's something I say I prioritize. And I'm going to go all the way. And I'm not drinking bad beer pretty much ever anymore. And it just makes me so happy. Like, when I have good beer, I don't drink a whole lot of it, but I always drink good stuff. And so every time I'm cracking a beer, it puts a big smile on my face.
I agree. And it also, for us, like, it lets us support our local economy because, you know, Vermont is a very small state. We have like, I don't know, 600,000 residents. And so putting our money locally is important to us, especially if it's beer.
All right, so Liz, let's kind of jump into your story. So you currently live, you know, there on your homestead, but that wasn't always the case. Can you share with our listeners sort of a quick little version of your story?
Sure. So my husband and I met in college, our freshman year, actually, and really were pretty conventional people, I would say, at that point in time. We graduated, we both got jobs, and we got engaged, got married when we were 24, which sounds so young now. It just sounds really young. But that's when we got married, and we thought at that point that we had essentially mapped out our lives. We were living in Cambridge outside of Boston. We both had great jobs and we figured, okay, what we're going to do is save money in order to buy a home and just keep sort of advancing in our careers, and we'll have kids and we'll live here and that will really be it. And that was the path that we followed until we hit 30. And when we turned 30, we had this realization that we'd been living in cities. During that time, we lived in New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., back up to Boston. We bought a home, we adopted a dog, and we had jobs that when we were 24, we thought would be our dream jobs. So here we are. We've essentially achieved everything we've set out to achieve, and we're 29 and 30 years old, and we are thinking, what are we doing with our lives? And that is a very privileged realization, but it's also very scary because everything we'd done up to that point, you know, our degrees, I'd gone to graduate school, all of the hours that we'd put in at our jobs. And here we're thinking, this is not what we want to be doing. And so we had a conversation that I detail in my book, The Coffee Shop Conversation. Yes, we were at a coffee shop drinking like really expensive lattes and saying, you know what? What are we doing? When are you happiest? And this was a little bit of a rhetorical question, but also, you know, we kind of turned to each other and said, no, really, like when are you actually happiest? And we realized that we're both happiest when we're out in the woods, when we're hiking. We started hiking together a couple of years after we got married and recognized that being in the woods for us represented this freedom and this loss of all of the expectations that we felt in our jobs, that we felt in society, and all of the stress, kind of the ambient stress that living in big cities put on us. We said, why are we paying to live in this city and then driving several hours in order to go hiking? You know, why don't we just move to the woods? And this started sort of the kickoff of what became Frugal Woods and the kickoff of our journey to financial independence. And it was a conversation that had a deadline that just kept accelerating. So initially we said, all right, we'll move to the woods when we retire at 65. And then we thought, well, maybe we could do it like when we're 40. And then we sat down, we looked at our numbers, we looked at what we were making, what we were spending, how much we had in savings. We said, you know, I think if we really focus, we could do this in under 5 years. And that was a very scary thought because we would be letting go of essentially these identities that we had created for ourselves. But it was also really exhilarating because we thought we can sort of chart a new life and we can create a totally different existence. Neither of us grew up rurally. And so moving out here to Vermont, we bought our home in late 2015, moved here in 2016. And we have 66 acres of woods and gardens and forests, and it's all new to us. And I think more than anything, what we love is that it is constant learning. We are just constantly making mistakes, constantly learning new things. And that to me is really invigorating.
That's a really interesting story, Liz. Take me back to those conversations, that coffee shop conversation, and then the conversations that you guys were having right after that. How intense were they? How hard was it for you guys to both get on the same page? Give me a window into kind of what those conversations were like.
At that point, we were very much on the same page. And I think at different points in our marriage, you know, we've been more or less on the same page. And at that point, we were sort of united in our feeling that we did not like what we were doing, which, you know, so we were sort of like, I don't know why we're living here. I don't know why we're doing these jobs. And that feeling was mutual. And I think that was a really fortunate thing. You know, it just sort of happened that way, that at that point in time, we both felt that kind of dissatisfaction with what we thought would be our ideal jobs. You know, what society was telling us at that time is, well, you should spend more money. You know, you should spend more money and that will yield fulfillment. And we were spending, you know, plenty of money at that point. And I realized it was really empty for me, you know, buying things, including craft beer, buying clothes, getting my hair done. It just wasn't the deep fulfillment. And the question that kept coming back to me over and over is, what am I doing with my life? What am I doing? Where am I going? When I am an old woman, what is it that I'm going to say I've done? And that really stuck a burr in me. And it was essentially this sort of tug that I could not turn away from. And Nate, my husband, felt much the same way. And he said, you know, I've always wanted to live in the woods. And I said, well, I've always wanted to be a writer. And we kind of looked at each other and said, well, why aren't we doing that then? You know, what's holding us back from that? And so I think when you are in a partnership, if you can sort of see what your partner needs and kind of recognize what their gifts are and when they thrive, I think that's a real moment for finding how you want to live your lives. And, you know, as your listeners know, how you use your money is going to be the type of life that you live. And so making that conscious choice at that point in time to stop spending our money and start saving it was a pretty, I won't say easy, but it was what we needed to do. We were both very bought into the idea.
There's a lot of power when you're working together like that with your spouse. And, you know, Liz, you mentioned how that timeline kind of accelerated, right? You mentioned 5 years. In the book, you mentioned how you had like a 3-year and 5-month plan. Were y'all able to actually stick to that amount of time, or what did, you know, did it happen sooner? Did it get pushed back a little bit?
So we ended up finding our homestead a little bit before we reached financial independence, but it was what we wanted. We were able to buy it without selling our home in Cambridge, because a piece of our financial independence strategy is that we rent out the home that we own in Cambridge. And so we were able to do that. And then we reached financial independence sort of shortly after making that move. And so the timeline synced up pretty well, but it kind of came down to the whims of real estate. If anybody has ever looked rurally, then you know that there are not that many properties. They don't come for sale very often, and they sit on the market. They can sit on the market for a very long time. So we needed to find something that kind of ticked all the boxes for us, because we did not want to move again. And we had thought about kind of a lot of different ways to make this move. You know, would we build from scratch? Would we buy something that wasn't finished yet? Would we sort of buy a multifamily in a city and, you know, renovate and rent out? Would we live in a tent? Would we, you know, what would we do? And we ended up realizing that we wanted to buy a finished home, and we wanted to buy a lot of land, and that ultimately we were pretty flexible on location, because we both work from home. And so we needed a good school district, and we needed a good land and a good house. And we found it, and it was pretty obvious to both of us that, like, this was the one. So we bought it. We closed on this house. I think it was the week after our first daughter was born, which is,
oh,
like,
my gosh.
I do not recommend that. Like, if anybody's wondering, like, don't do that. But that's just, it's how it happened. And it was the one. I could not let this house go. So.
But doesn't it always happen that way? I feel like anytime there's a large life change that happens, there's always like multiple life changes that happen all at once.
Especially when you're in your late 20s, early 30s, making decisions like that. I mean, yeah, kids, houses, all that kind of stuff. Just sometimes it all goes down in the same week and gets crazy.
Yeah, I think so. And it's so funny, because I always tell people, like, don't make several life decisions at once. And then, you know, I had a baby and bought a house. So it's like, I don't know. My thought about this is, like, do your research, spend a lot of time researching. And then be ready to kind of take a risk, but take a risk strategically. You know what you're getting into, but at the same time, there comes a point where you have to just decide, okay, am I going to regret doing this or not doing this more?
So you mentioned keeping that house in Cambridge, and that was a part of your financial independence plan. What made that an important piece of your plan to achieve financial independence? And how has that investment property really impacted you guys on your way towards hitting that goal?
So the reason it's important is it provides a great source of passive income. I wouldn't say that it's necessary to financial independence. You know, there's certainly the option of selling that home. And I think if you're looking at the rent versus sell, I think you need to do a lot of calculations. So we did, there was a lot of math and spreadsheets that went into this decision. And there may come a point at which we do decide to sell it. But so far, the rent has been fantastic. And it's really providing a great passive income stream. We have a property manager, which for us has been the best decision. We are serious insourcers and major DIYers, and my husband can, like, he can do plumbing, he can do electrical, he can do everything. But it came down to, listen, if this is really gonna be passive income, it has to actually be passive. We can't be running down there. It's 3 hours away. So we can't be driving 3 hours to, like, you know, repair a toilet or replumb the kitchen or whatever it is. So paying for a property manager has been really, really worthwhile in making it a truly passive investment. So I think if you're looking at this, you have to decide, you know, do I live locally? Do I want to be doing the repairs? Or is the math going to work out that I can pay a property manager, you know, and still net a really good return on that investment? So I think it's always a question of how handy you are and how hands-on you want to be with the property. So it's for us that the property manager and the location of the rental has really worked out well. It's in between Harvard University and MIT. And so there's
bunch of dummies up there, right?
I mean it. So, you know, the great thing is like there's a constant flow of graduate students who need housing for a year, a couple years, but who don't want to buy. And another factor for us is that I think it's like 65% of units in Cambridge are rented. So the rental population is really robust. In terms of vacancy, we always project out for having vacancy, but knock on wood, we haven't had any vacancy yet. So I think it's, as with anything, you really need to know the market. For us, when we bought this house, one of the reasons we bought it is because we thought it would make a good rental. And it does. It was not our dream home. You know, we really bought it thinking, okay, it's a standalone. It has a good number of bedrooms, good number of bathrooms. It's fairly updated. It's in a great neighborhood. And we thought this could be a really good rental. And so that kind of went into our decision with buying it. And I would say we did the exact opposite with the home that we live in here in Vermont. This would be a terrible rental. So, you know, so it's like you kind of need to know, like, am I buying this house because I may one day want to flip it or may one day want to rent it? Or is this just like my long-term dream family home? And so for us, you know, in our financial projections, our Vermont home is a zero on our balance sheets. We do not count this property as anything. Whereas the Cambridge home is really seen as an asset. So I think it's just important to know that when you're going into buying something.
Yeah, I mean, and thinking back to, you know, you mentioned how he's super handy. You're Miss Frugalwoods, and being handy and being able to DIY things that like really ties into being frugal. It's a hard decision I found to actually say no to things that, you know, like that you could possibly do. But when you actually take the time to sit back and sort of assess, like, does this line up with my overall vision? Do I want to be spending my time doing this? That certainly makes some of those decisions a lot easier. And it sounds like that's what y'all were able to do.
Absolutely. And it really came down to like, okay, yeah, we could, you know, drive 6 hours in a day in order to go and, you know, have Nate install the new oven that they needed or to repair the toilet because he can do all of that. But it's just, it's not worth it. And I think it's really important to put a dollar amount on your time or even just put a value on your time, because it time and money, right? Those are the two resources. And especially since having kids, it's really obvious to us that time is the greater resource.
All right, Liz, that's awesome. And so we've got a lot more questions about frugality because you have called yourself an extreme frugal person. And I love that. I love that you lend yourself towards extreme frugality. And so we're going to get into some of the ways that you have positioned yourself as an extreme frugalist and how other people can kind of learn from that right after the break.
All right, we're back from the break with Liz Thames. And Liz, before your book came out, you were completely anonymous and you only went by Miss Frugalwoods. So obviously we have to talk about frugality. What does it mean to you to be frugal?
For me, it means aligning my spending with my values. It does not mean pinching every last penny. It does not mean saving as much as I can. It really means focusing on my priorities. So spending on what matters and then saving in all of the areas that don't matter to me. So I think a good example is the craft beer. You know, my husband and I, we enjoy craft beer. It's a hobby as well as a passion. We love to go to tastings.
Yes,
we love
speaking our language.
Oh my gosh, we love having friends over. And like, we had the Mad Scientist and his wife come, and we did like a blind taste test where we all tried to identify the beers.
Were you do assessments?
Yeah, none of us could do it. We were like, I don't know.
But so awesome.
You know, I enjoy, so there's a lot of joy and pleasure and community that comes from that. Now, so a way that we save money is with haircuts. I cut my husband's hair and he cuts my hair and I cut our oldest daughter's hair. And so this is, we have calculated over the years, like actual thousands of dollars that we're saving because I don't really care what my hair looks like. And my husband doesn't really care what his hair looks like. And so it's really deciding, okay, where am I getting the best return on my investment? Where do I want to be putting my money? not everything can be a sacred cow. Not everything can be prioritized. So what matters to me, where do I want to spend the money, and then what doesn't? So we buy a lot of organic produce. I buy a lot of organic meats, local meat, local eggs from my neighbors. It's much more expensive to buy from them, but I would much rather do that. But then for things like my kids' clothes, books, toys, those are all used and from garage sales for, you know, $1, $2. So again, it's really deciding how I want to allocate the resources that I have towards my values. And I think there are different levels of this that you can kind of ramp up and down depending on what your goal is. So when my husband and I started the financial independence journey, we cut out everything. There was no craft beer going on. All right. It was pretty dire. We decided we needed to save as much as we could because we wanted to reach financial independence. So that was one way of living. You know, that was like pretty bare bones frugality. And I share our monthly spending on the blog, and I've been doing it for 5 years now. So you can look back, you know, kind of in the early days, and compared to what we spend now, we spend so much money now, you know, by comparison. But it's all on things that we've thought about and things that we've made conscious choices about. And I think when you are conscious about your spending, when you know how much you're spending every month, you know what you're spending on, and it's all meaningful to you, that's an essence of frugality.
Yeah, I think so many people are unwilling to even consider cutting their partner's hair or vice versa, right? That's like something that's not even on the table. And I love that you just, part of frugality is putting more things on the table and being willing to consider it, right? And think about it. Think outside the box a little bit. I specifically want to ask you, Liz, you lived in a couple of major cities. You lived in some really expensive places before you moved out to your homestead in Vermont. So how were you able to, in particular, inside of a big city? Because we've got listeners who live in LA, New York. We've got folks that live in a lot of big cities. Matt and I live in a big city. What are your suggestions, and how are you best able to exercise frugality even while living in a major city?
So I have actually found that it's less expensive to live in a city than it is to live rurally, which I know is not what people think. And I wrote a post about this because I wanted to analyze our spending for a year in the city and a year in the country. And sure enough, we spent more in the country. And so I think when you're in a city, you have so many things that you can take advantage of. So you might be able to go without a car. My husband and I were car free for a while. And if your employer offers a transit pass or any kind of reimbursement, you know, sometimes there's an option to buy a transit pass pre-tax through your employer. These are all ways that you're saving. So if you don't have a car, obviously that's a ton of embodied costs that you're saving. You have more options. So you have competition in grocery stores. You have competition for just about every service. Whereas rurally, you know, there's kind of like one grocery store. You're kind of beholden to whatever their prices are. But when you're in a city, you really can comparison shop in every sense. Also, the used market in the city is on point. You can find anything. Specifically, you can find things for free. So when I lived in New York City and in Boston especially, I found almost everything for free on the side of the road because people move a lot. You know, it's a very transient culture. People are not interested in extracting a return on their investment of furniture or whatever it may be. And so it's out by the side of the road. They have to move, whatever. It's out there. You take it. This is a good deal. So I found that living in the city really, really enables frugality if you are thoughtful and careful about it. And I have a couple posts on it if anybody is interested. I think the big unavoidable cost is housing. So housing is going to be more expensive in a city. But if you are willing to sacrifice or you're willing to be strategic, you know, there are ways that you can make that work to your advantage. So my husband and I lived in a basement apartment near Central Square in Cambridge and paid just a fantastic rate. You know, we saved a lot of money by living there. And our landlord did not raise our rent for a couple of years because we were great tenants. And we went out of our way to be great tenants. You know, I baked him cookies, our landlord. We kept it so clean and tried really hard to sort of engender that good relationship because we did not want our rent raised. And so I think anything you can do to facilitate a lower housing cost in almost every other avenue of life, you can often spend less if you are in a major city.
Well, if you ever move to Atlanta, you and Nate can totally rent one of my places because I love cookies. So,
hey, there you go. I would bake you cookies anyway.
All right. Nice.
So, Liz, you know, in your book, and you often talk about being frugal, like out of necessity versus being frugal sort of from a place of privilege. When you were living in New York City, like you talk about how you were on food stamps. And so do you feel that that was the period of your life when you were being frugal because you had to, because that was just what was needed to survive? And then, so that's part one of the question. And then the second part is, how are you frugal enough to still be able to save some of your income? Because I know you were working hard to save your money while you were living in New York City as well. So two parts for you there.
Sure. So when I lived in Brooklyn, I was working for AmeriCorps and I made $10,000 and then saved $2,000 of it. And that was a difficult year. You know, that's not an experience I really want to repeat, because that was frugality out of necessity and it wasn't a lot of fun. So I think there's a lot of privilege in what I do now in choosing to save money. There's just so much embedded privilege there versus needing to save money. And even when I was in AmeriCorps, you know, had I really come into dire straits, my family would have helped me out. You know, my parents or my siblings would have helped me out. So there are still layers and layers of privilege that go into that experience. So during that year, I really had to think about every dollar I spent, and that's exhausting. And I think, you know, anyone who has lived that way, who has to live that way, recognizes how exhausting that is to always focus on money and to always be worried that you will not have enough money. At the same time, it taught me the lessons of how creative I can be and how out of the box I can be with coming up with solutions. So I found a lot of free entertainment. You know, I figured out which museums were free. I figured out where I could get discount produce. I figured out where free meals were offered. You know, it was an opportunity for me to really think hard about how I could enjoy the city, but not spend any money. And at the same time, I was, you know, so fortunate. I was single. I didn't have any kids. So that is made the whole experience a lot easier. I really cannot imagine doing it now with children.
Mm, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine with kids. It changes everything, right? There's so much more to consider. Liz, once you guys hatched your plan to move out to the country, you mentioned some of kind of the crazy frugal things that you did, like, you know, and you still do, giving each other haircuts. But what are some of the other major things that you did that people might think are outside of the box or a little zany? And in particular, I want to hear about your DIY seltzer that you make at home and to save a ton of money.
Oh yeah, the DIY seltzer. So this comes from, I am not kidding, my husband and I will sit down in the evening and we'll look around the house and think like, I wonder if there's a better way that we could do that. And so he and I both have this sort of sense of efficiency and this desire to create efficiencies and to create strategy around a lot of the things we do. Our household is very routine driven and very sort of formulaic in some ways, because that really works for our personalities. So I think if you have that personality, or if you want to cultivate that personality, look around your house and think, what could I be doing better? And that is how the homemade seltzer hack came about. So I've written about this on the blog a couple times, and we are obsessed with seltzer, which is sparkling water. we could just drink plain water, I'll be honest, but it's one of those things that we really enjoy. And so we were spending money on plastic bottles from the grocery store of seltzer. We're like, there has to be a better way. So we got a SodaStream, and that cut down the cost per serving. Those are individual canisters that you buy to create your own seltzer. But then we thought, wait a minute, these canisters are, I think they were $15 for these tiny canisters. We're like, why can't we just get a huge tank of CO2? So we looked into it, and this is where it really helps that Nate is handy, because I would not have figured this out. He figured out that we could hack the SodaStream and hook it up to, I think it's a 30-pound canister of CO2, which costs us, I think, $30. So you're looking at, you know, just pennies per serving of seltzer. And so this is an idea of sort of an idea of hacking your life, and really an idea of creating efficiencies. So this comes to bear for us in how we cook, how we clean, how we raise our kids, the buying choices that we make. I think when you are willing to be open to different alternatives, when you're willing to settle for something that's not perfect, you know, does it look perfect that I have this like 30 pound canister of CO2 in my kitchen? Probably not, but it's a conversation starter and I don't really care. You know, I think letting go of this idea that I need to have perfect hair or a perfect looking kitchen, allowing myself to be okay with the imperfect really lets you save a lot of money and I think enjoy life a lot more.
Hey, I think your enormous CO2 canister is totally Instagram worthy, Liz, okay?
You know, it's never been on Instagram.
You got to put it up there.
People want to see that.
That's right.
Do they though? I mean, it really, like, it's not that attractive.
After this conversation, they totally want to.
I mean, I picture one of the, so. is it just one of those like tall, skinny tanks that you see on the back of trucks with like 30 other ones? Okay.
It's not. There's nothing special.
Well, obviously, so that's something frugal that you can do regardless where you live. Liz, you know, you mentioned some of the different things you did there in the city. So now that you live out there on some land, right, like you mentioned, your 66 acres, what are some ways that you're able to save a ton of money now by flexing your homesteading frugal muscles? I assume that you are doing things differently there on the farm than you were in the city.
So we're saving absolutely no money with our land. I think so. We do a lot that I think will in the long run be frugal, but in the short term is very expensive. So, and this is kind of one of those things that I have written about a couple times that I think for people who don't live rurally, it's hard to sort of understand how expensive it is to be sustainable and to be self-sufficient. So we have solar panels. So we generate just about all of our energy, but we had to pay for those solar panels, right? So that was a pretty large upfront investment. Will that pay off in the time that we live in this home? You know, I hope so. We heat our home with wood that grows on our property that we harvest ourselves. So you'd think, oh, free heat, right? We have like no heating bill. But at the same time, it's hours and hours of my husband's time. And it's also the cost of a chainsaw, a tractor, you know, chainsaw gear, a woodshed that my husband built himself. And then really just all of the labor and time of heating with wood. So it's, you know, it's very easy to kind of see it as something that is free if you don't kind of recognize all of the costs that are behind it. And for us, we choose to do these things because we love it. We love our wood stove. My husband loves, you know, felling trees and bucking logs and splitting wood. And so that's a passion for him. I love having wood heat in the house, but to say that it's free, you know, kind of discounts the costs that go into it. And the same goes for our garden. So we grow tons and tons of food and we preserve it and process it. But that is, you know, a huge amount of labor hours. And it's also fairly expensive when you look at seeds and gardening equipment. You can look at my expense report and just see like the amount of, you know, stuff that we end up needing. Overalls, boots, fruit pickers, you know, it's, I think it's possible that in 10 or 15 or 20 years, we might sort of start to see that return on investment. But I wouldn't want anyone to go into the idea of kind of subsistence farming or even generating a profit from agriculture and thinking that it's easy or that, you know, it's a very straightforward thing.
Yeah. Well, at least Nate doesn't have to go to the gym splitting his own wood.
Yeah, we don't have to pay for a gym membership, which is good because there is no gym.
Yeah. Rural Vermont doesn't have like LA Fitness, no?
I know, right? And so, you know, again, for us, it's like we love it. Like we love doing this. And so I think it's important to recognize how you enjoy spending your time.
So Liz, you've also talked about kind of some of the side benefits that frugality can offer. So it's not just saving money. It's not just being able to invest more and save more for the future. What are some of the biggest benefits to frugality aside from just being able to have more money to save and invest?
So I find that it's more environmentally friendly. The less that you are consuming, the less that you're buying, I think the fewer sort of carbon costs that you're incurring. I think when you are concerned about how much you're spending commuting, you're likely to have a fuel efficient car or walk or use transit. So we have a Toyota Prius. And then our other car is a truck, a Toyota Tundra, because we live in the woods. And so I think when you are thinking about saving money, but also impacting the environment, there's a great sort of synergy that happens there. I also find that frugality builds community. So with a lot of my friends, a lot of our connections started through sort of helping each other, sharing our resources, giving things to each other, and really finding a way to build a community that's not based on money, but that's based on barter and trade. And I think barter and trade is alive and well and is in a city near you. I think there are a lot of people who would love to be living that way and love to be trading services versus paying for them. So we can, when you can tap into that network, it's such a wonderful community to open up.
Awesome. So we're going to talk more with Liz here about basically the rhythms of their life there out in Vermont, as well as some different ways that folks can become frugal if they don't self-identify as being frugal. But first, a quick break. We're back. We're talking with Liz Timms. She is the writer behind the popular blog frugalwoods.com. And Liz, you've talked on your blog about how your initial plunge into frugality, it was mainly about money in the beginning. But after a while, as it does for everyone who starts to think about money intentionally, it kind of morphs into thinking more about time prioritization. Can you talk about how that changed for you over time as you began to kind of dive more into that mindset of trying to achieve financial independence?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, when you start, you're in your first month of this financial independence journey, it is all about the money, you know, and you're really thinking like, okay, I will do anything to save a dollar or a quarter. And as time goes on, as you said, I think you really start to realize that it's all about your time. And an exercise, two exercises that really work well for me are the dream bio exercise, which is where you kind of write out how ideally you would like your life to be presented. So what would you like your bio to be? And what are you doing to get yourself to that? And what are you doing to hinder yourself? And then the other piece is the obituary piece, which I don't know.
That sounds fun.
I know, right? But it's like thinking about, hopefully you live to an old age and you've passed away. What is it that you want people to say that you have done? And what do you want to point to that you've done with your life? And so I think I came to realize that how I used my time was going to inform those two elements, probably more than how I used my money. But it goes back to how you use your money is how your life is going to play out. So for me, it's kind of this interconnected web of the choices that I make with my money and then the choices that I make with my time. And there are times when I spend money in order to spend less time. And there are also times when I'm very happy to spend more time in order to save money. And so I think it's kind of knowing where you derive joy, what really brings you fulfillment, and what you're happy to pay other people to do. So I just had a post about what we have for lunch. And one of the things I do for lunch is I buy chicken thighs that are like, they're already like deboned and like in the little package. I don't roast a whole chicken. And I have plenty of friends out here who raise a chicken. They grow the chicken, they slaughter the chicken, they pluck the chicken, they roast the chicken. You know, they do the entire process. But for me, it's like, I don't find fulfillment in raising a chicken. I just, it's not,
or
you know,
killing
it's
a chicken.
Like, that just doesn't sound good. I know, but they do it. I mean, you want to know where your food comes from. For me, it's not something I want to do. So I'm willing to spend the money to buy chicken that someone else has prepared. So I think it's being very conscious in all of those decisions and recognizing I do have a choice. And in this case, I choose to spend the money. Another instance, I make my own applesauce. So I harvest the apples from our tree. I peel and core them. I boil them down. I put them on the stove. I can them. I hot water bath can them. You know, this is like fairly time consuming, but I love doing it. I love having that fresh applesauce for my kids. And so that's a choice where I'm making to spend more time, but save money. So I think it's really coming to terms with how you want to use your time. And for me, having a weekly schedule and kind of a weekly view of what I do with my time is really important. And it's my husband and I, we have a shared Google Calendar. We have these like constant sort of check-ins about, you know, what we want to accomplish that day and how we're going to use our time. And it's always a balance between being outside, being inside, being with our kids, being away from our kids, and making that choice of what we need to feel whole.
one of the reasons you have those options, Liz, is because you have been frugal, right? Like you've done smart things with your money. You've been frugal, and that allows you to prioritize certain things over others. You talk about the sort of daily rhythm of life that you have there on the farm where you are able to say, you know what, like it's time for me to spend some time outside. I'm done writing. You talk about like the sort of balance that you're able to strive after between doing things that are more like cerebral, like more mental, and the things that you want to do that are also physical. Can you talk about that sort of balance a little bit?
Yes, that we, so Nate and I have realized that's kind of like what we both need in our lives. Like I really need to write. I love being a writer and I need to do that. I need that fulfillment. I took a break after my first daughter was born and didn't write for about 2 months. And it was one of the worst 2 month periods of my life because I was not receiving that fulfillment. And I realized I need to be doing this. So after my second daughter was born, I did not take a break, which may also not have been the best decision, but I really need that outlet for myself. And similarly, my husband is a software engineer and he loves doing that. He needs time on the computer using that part of his brain. And then he needs to get outside and like split some wood, you know, or plant a garden or harvest tomatoes. And so I think recognizing what you need in order to be fulfilled and not pigeonholing yourself. So I am not a full-time homesteader. I am not a full-time writer. I am not a full-time mother. You know, all of these things I do in increments that facilitate the way that I want to be spending my time. And I think just being honest with yourself about what you need is something that I've struggled with as a parent. And, you know, I've struggled with acknowledging I love my kids, but I need time away from them. You know, I need to be able to work. I need to be able to have that intellectual fulfillment and then have that time outside without them too. Because outside with your kids is one thing, outside without them is a very different thing. So knowing that like I need time to do yoga, I need time to hike, I need time with my friends without my kids. And the same goes for my husband. And so, you know, really finding a way to kind of create those opportunities within a family. And a lot of what we have done is eliminate the stuff that doesn't matter.
So it sounds like you've been able to find just such an awesome rhythm. And
I mean, it changes every day. Like, let's be honest. Yeah, right. Please. Like I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. So this is not like Nirvana over
no,
here.
No, no, no.
Right?
Of course. Of course. We know that all too well. Matt's got 4 kids. I've got 3. Life is insane most days. But it does sound like you guys have found a pace of life that suits you guys. And you had this massive goal to move to Vermont to this homestead. And obviously getting there, it took 3 years and 5 months, pretty much. It was this kind of years long process of achieving this massive goal. What's it like, not just in the day to day, but what are your long term goals now? And what's it like to set new goals once you feel like you've achieved this intense, amazing, massive goal that you set after and it took years to get to?
It's interesting. I don't, you know, we don't really have like a next goal, but we have progressions on this goal because the homestead, as we see it, is still really coming to fruition. So every year we kind of refine what we plant in the garden, what we preserve. You know, the first year, like most of our apples rotted because we didn't know what we were doing. I was like crying and he was like, oh my God, the apples rotted. Nate's like, it's okay. The next year we made cider. You know, this year we're like on schedule with cider. We've got people coming to help us. Like we're friends who we've conned into doing this. I should be clear. And so it's every year we kind of get better. So the idea of having an ultimate goal when living rurally, it's really hard to see that because it's a constant progression of goals. So Nate had this goal of having 3 years worth of firewood in our woodshed. And so, well, first he had to build the woodshed. So last summer he built the woodshed and then this year he got up to 3 years of firewood, which is 9 cords, which I know to people in the city, they're like, what, 9 cords?
What's a cord?
Listen, it's a lot of wood.
It's a lot of
right?
wood. It's a lot.
It's a lot of firewood. So he's achieved that, but now he is like immediately pivoted into another goal. And I'm kind of very much the same way. You know, I always wanted to write a book. So I wrote a book that was awesome. And then I kind of pivoted into other goals. And so I think, you know, being nimble and realizing that a lot of times achieving a goal is just an avenue into finding new goals. And so I think in a lot of ways, this is our ultimate goal. I don't see us moving. We don't plan on leaving Vermont. I really kind of can't imagine ever leaving this property. I just, we're so deeply connected to where we live now, but the way in which we homestead, the way in which we spend our time, that will evolve and that will change. And each year that our kids get older, we have different commitments with them. And I'm very open to sort of seeing how all of that unfolds. I also want to say that, you know, being financially independent, there's so much privilege in that, because if we decided tomorrow, okay, we're done, we need to move, we could do that and it wouldn't be a financial challenge. So I think there's a lot of privilege and there's a lot of freedom that comes from financial independence and that comes from having that ability to say, you know what, this isn't working for me anymore. I need to go try something different.
So for someone specifically who's listening who doesn't think that they're frugal, or they just know that they're not frugal, like, what do you think are the keys to making frugality fun, and how do you make it to be something that's ingrained, something that sticks with you?
So I wouldn't focus on money at first. I would very much focus on where you want to be in 10 years. So, you know, write this out. Where do you want to be in 10 years in terms of your finances, your career, and your lifestyle? You know, if you, again, this goes back to kind of that dream bio exercise. Like, what do you want to be doing? When you really think about it, what do you want to be doing? What do you want to say you have accomplished? And how are you going to make your money work towards that goal? Because again, the money is just a tool. It's not the end all be all. It's very much a way to facilitate the life you want to live. So identify what that life is. I think for a lot of folks, for me in particular, I spent the most money when I did not know what I wanted to do. You know, when
right,
I...
Yeah, because you're trying everything, right?
Yeah, and you're like, I don't know, maybe I
want to... Let me try that.
Yeah, maybe I want to be going to brunch all the time. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's not
I
bad.
I could be a brunch person.
I like
mimosas
French toast
every Sunday. Come on.
Yeah.
I like breakfast too.
Exactly. And so it's like spending money is a very easy way to explore yourself. And I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, I don't think it's a bad thing to spend money and kind of see, like, I don't know, does this bring you fulfillment? Maybe it does. So maybe you need to like make a lot of money, you know, in order to spend a lot of money. So it's, I think you really need to identify what that long-term goal is. And I have, okay, so self-promotion on Frugal Woods, I have a free challenge. It's the Uber Frugal Month Challenge. It's 31 days. It's free. It's by email. And it takes you through this process. So it goes through the whole process that Nate and I went through of identifying, like, what are those goals and what do we need to do to reach them? And I think one of the things that I realized is, like, maybe the goal is nebulous, right? Maybe I'm not totally sure of the goal, but what I do know is that having money is going to help facilitate whatever that goal ends up being. I don't think anyone has ever said, oh gosh, I wish I'd saved less money. Gosh, I wish I'd had, you know, more debt. I don't think people have really said that. And so coming at it from that aspect, from, you know, from that perspective, okay, I'm going to put myself in a great financial position and then I'll be able to make the choices that I want to make.
Yeah, lean towards savings first, right? And I love how the why can really help facilitate frugality in your life. Hey, Liz, this has been just such a fun conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll link to your Uber Frugal Challenge in our show notes. But can you tell our listeners where they can find out more about you?
You can find me at frugalwoods.com. And then I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at frugalwoods.
All right, and we'll be waiting for that Instagram shot of your CO2 tank shortly.
All right. I will do that. Thank you awesome. So much for having
yeah.
me.
Yeah, Liz, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right, Matt, that was such a fun conversation with Liz. Obviously, she is just an honorary member of the podcast now that if she loves craft beer as much as we do.
Man, I don't think we've had a guest on that appreciated craft beer, I think, as much as Liz does. She was naming some great breweries, and it's very clear that it's a priority for them. So I'm totally going to let it slide that she also said craft beer was her splurge.
I love it. She's gone like Steve Urkel level nerding out on craft beer just like we do.
She's come out the other side as Stefan. She's going that hard.
Super cool. But Matt, what was your big takeaway from this conversation?
Yeah, man. You know, for me, it was really surprising and it really caught me off guard that she mentioned how their homestead, their gardens, their fruit trees, just all that they have going on there, that it's not saving them money, that in fact, it costs them a lot of money. And, you know, we joked a lot about her her gas tank for her seltzer water about putting that on Instagram. But it makes me think how there are so many homesteads out there that you see on social media with these beautiful gardens. They're magazine worthy, you know, what they're kind of putting out there. But the truth is that those beautiful pieces of land, those properties, like all that costs so much money, especially if you're going to try to get it to look good, right? Like aside from it just producing something, if you want it to look great like that, it costs a lot of money. And so I guess my big takeaway there is to know that if you're going to do something like that, make sure that you're doing it for you. And that's what her and Nate are doing. They're doing it because they value that lifestyle. They value being able to grow their own food, but it's not because it's necessarily the super affordable option. She mentioned how it's more affordable to live in a city because there's so many things that you have access to. And it might be easy for us, maybe for me living in a city, to always think that the grass is greener, right, on the other side. But in reality, it's not. So for her, I think it was a great message. It was a great way that she was showing that she was living out what was important to her and her family living out there on that farm.
Yeah, I think some people idealize that rural homesteading kind of life. And it sounds like they do have a really cool life out there. For me, it's just not something that appeals to me at all. Like I see myself living in a city probably for the rest of my life. But I know you, it's something you've thought about. But it is just interesting how people idealize it. And they also think they're going to save money, but that's not always necessarily the case.
Exactly.
So I think my big takeaway was something that she said really struck me. She said, not everything can be prioritized. I think most of us walk through our lives and we don't think about cutting our own hair or cutting our partner's hair or all these little things that we can do to save money. 15 bucks here, 20 bucks there. It all adds up. But basically, we can't prioritize everything. We can't do it all. And if we're willing to put more things on the table and cut back, whether that's literally cutting each other's hair or other things that you just haven't really thought about, cutting out of your life or changing altogether your approach to it, I think we could all stand to learn a bit from Liz's extreme frugal mindset. And we could probably put some expenses up on the chopping block that we previously thought were untouchable, right? She said, not everything can be a sacred cow. And I completely agree. I think we have too many sacred cows. We have too many things that we're unwilling to touch in our budget and in our finances every month. And if we were a little more willing to look a little more deeply and start cutting a little more viciously in regards to what we're spending every month, I think it actually might make us happier as well as lead us towards saving more money.
Yeah, exactly, man. It's a good challenge to push ourselves to be creative in the ways that we're able to cut back and save money. All right, man, let's take it back now to the beer, which is something that you and I are not willing to cut back on.
Never.
On this episode, we had Boss Tweed, which is a beer by Old Nation. Man, this is a personal favorite for you. This is a personal favorite for me. This is a beer that I think I could never grow tired of.
Yeah, man, it's pretty close to a perfect IPA in my estimation. It's one that is pretty much always in my fridge at this point. It randomly kind of showed up on store shelves in our city probably about a year ago. And I distinctly remember a couple people just raving about it. And so I picked up a 4-pack and I was like, oh, wow, this is really, really, really good. So yeah, I find myself drinking it a lot because it's so dang tasty. So I'm glad we were able to drink this on the show tonight, man. Just a really solid IPA. And if you do have Old Nation Brewing at a store near you, go pick some up like tomorrow.
Yeah, man, it is that good. If you love IPAs, you will love this beer. It's a double IPA, so it's got that perfect balance of sweetness, but at the same time, just incredible hoppiness. I literally can't get enough of this beer in my life, man. So that's going to be it for this episode. You can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll have some links there pointing you towards where you can find Liz online,
including that super cool Uber Frugal Month Challenge. And if you like the show and if you want to be informed every time we release an episode, be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening. And we really appreciate you listening. Matt and I have a good time creating this podcast, and the interaction that we get from our listeners is incredible. So thank you so much. And Matt, that'll do it. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.